talk for about 40 minutes and then we'll have lots of time for questions. But I'm quite an informal chair, so if anybody feels a burning urge to join in, join in. Welcome. We've actually met before because Anna Rada came in and did a podcast, so we've sort of opened up some of the issues in this novel, which I still have a tatty proof copy. Yes. I haven't actually been treated to a, as you can see, it's very dog-eared and marked. It's had a full and varied life already. It's the story of what is it the story of? It's set over 5 days.
Yes.
And there it's actually pretty controversial in some of its parts.
It is actually about people facing completely unexpected situations in their lives by being in this different setting. And sometimes they've planned to be there, and at other times they just found themselves there. But they're at crossroads in their lives where they have to face things they haven't before, and this often brings them to some point of crisis. That's what it's.
And the setting is completely—it's a completely unfamiliar setting to even as to people. Now I read quite a lot of Indian fiction, but it's a town of pilgrimage by the sea.
Yes.
But of Hindu pilgrimage.
Yes, it's a town by the sea, which is full of temples and which has some temples which are ruined ones and some which are still in use and is frequented by pilgrims who are. You know, everybody in that town is usually there because they are religious or they are coping with questions of belief and faith. And that is what most of the people in the book are doing as well in different ways. And some have been scarred by religion and some have been enriched by it, but they are there because of that. And it's a town which brings together religion and sexuality in a very odd sort of way.
It's a sort of tourist novel in a way, because they're all tourists in different ways, aren't they?
Yes, they're religious tourists, most of them, except the ones who live in the town and are part of the infrastructure that's showing these people around. So it's all about travel. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Will you read us a little bit from the beginning of it so we get a sense of it?
I'll just read the first couple of pages. Am I audible at the back? Because I've lost my voice, I'm not sure. Do I need to speak louder?
Just a little, please.
Okay. The year the war came closer, I was 6 or 7, and it did not matter to me. I lived with my brother, father and mother, and our hut had 2 rooms with mats on the floor and a line of wooden pegs from which our clothes hung. And in the evening, we sat in the yard outside, watching our mother cook on the fire by the grapefruit tree. When the tree flowered, I opened my mouth wide to swallow the scent. Little green beads of fruit appeared when the flowers fell off. One day, when some of the fruit had turned as round and yellow as full moons, my brother climbed the tree. He looked tall and strong, clambering from branch to branch, my older brother. I stood holding the trunk, waiting for the fruit to come down. He snapped them off the stem, the branch shook hard, and I was showered with dust and dry leaves. The grapefruit were pale yellow outside, with stippled skin. They were big as melons and heavy with juice. My mother slid a knife into one and cut it in half, and the flesh was pink, and the smell of its juice was tart and fresh. Our hut was all we knew, the 4 of us. I remember a fence around it made of branches my father cut and brought home on his shoulders a few at a time every day. The jungle was thick. The leaves of the tall trees were broad and green. I've tried to remember which trees they were, but I can only bring back the ones that gave me things to eat. Mangoes, grapefruit, jackfruit, and lime. We had hens that went mad cackling and crowing when they were laying eggs. Their eggs were brown. We had a cow, a few goats, and 3 pigs. When the pigs were slaughtered for their meat, they shrieked with a sound that made my teeth fall off. And this was the sound I heard soon after my mother cut the grapefruit and the men came in with axes. Their faces were wrapped in cloth. They shoved my brother outside. They pushed my mother and me to a corner of the room, and then they flung my father at a wall. They slammed his face at the wall again and again. The whitewashed wall streamed red. They threw him to the floor and kicked him with their booted feet. Each time the boots hit him, it was as if a limp bundle of clothes were being tossed this way and that. Then one of the men lifted an axe and brought it down on my father's forehead. When they left, they wrote something on the wall in his blood. They did not look at us. In my sleep, I hear the sound of pigs at slaughter, the sound my father made. The next thing was a clump of bushes by a ditch. My mother was hiding me in the bushes. Smoke rose from the place where our village was, not the smoke of cooking fires, but a kind I had never seen before. It made the blue sky black and stilled the birds. There was not a sound. I started to shout for my brother, but my mother put her palm over my mouth. If only she hadn't stopped me. He always came when I called, and he always knew what to do. I was walking after that, as fast as I could. But still my mother kept pulling at my hand and dragging me, saying, "Faster, faster." Then she picked me up, and I was on her back, and my arms were wrapped around her. She ran through the jungle. My legs straddled her waist, my head reached her shoulders, but I could not look beyond. Her hair pricked my eyes, it was sticky with sweat and dirt. Her feet were bare. She stopped to pluck thorns from them, and once she stopped to tear off a strip from her sari and wrap it around her foot where a stone gashed it. If I asked for my brother, she said, quiet, not a word. My mother's face was fierce. She had thick, straight eyebrows, and she wore a nose pin that sparkled like a star. Her palm felt rough and hard when it slapped my cheek and when it rubbed oil into me before a bath. Although I scrape and scrape at my mind, there is not much else I can bring back.
Thank you. You might wonder what that has to do with 5 days of religious pilgrimage, and actually yes. that is the first introduction to Noma, who is one of the central characters, and it's a flashback.
Yes, it is.
So although it's the structure is 5 days, it loops back into...
Yeah, it keeps going back to her. When she comes to this seaside town, she's not absolutely sure that this was the town she grew up in. She sort of knows, but... I can tell you the whole story of the book, which would not be
clever. We have to not tell. We have to be quite careful how much we give away, don't
we? Well, she has been brought to this city. I will not tell you how. And she's grown up there, but in a place that is quite secluded. And so she's not absolutely sure whether she's coming back to the right place. And for her, it's a search for where she grew up.
This place that she is in, where there's a war, this isn't India, is it?
No.
But where is it?
She is... I didn't want the place to be named. I know in my head what place it is, but I didn't want it to be named because I wanted it to be a sort of more generalized thing. And I wanted her to be a more generalized, in a sense, refugee child, and to see what happens to this child who has had her whole life turned upside down by this war and has lost her entire family.
That is the de facto big opening scene. But in a way, the opening scene comes in the second chapter when three old ladies sit on a train and there is a young woman on the train with them.
Yes.
Who, there's a sort of incident. She gets off and fails to get back on the train. And that's in the present day frame of the 5 days they're on their way to the pilgrimage.
Yes.
And that is Noma in your future life.
This getting off the train, and everybody asks you, is your book autobiographical at some point? But this getting off the train and not getting on is the only part of the book that is autobiographical. Because I once was traveling to Dehradun for the Mussoorie Literary Festival, and it appeared to, the stop appeared to be a long one. And I was very hungry, so I got off the train to buy myself something to eat. And they were taking ages to return my change. And then I just saw this train being there. And someone tapped me and said, and my luggage was in the train. So I began to run, and I actually got on this running train, stupidly, because you fall in those circumstances. And my heart was exploding with terror, but I realized I had neither dropped my bag, nor the chips, nor the coke.
Gosh! That's quite impressive.
And she too gets on the train again, yeah.
So that encounter on the train is with these three elderly women, and that's again they're quite a startling trio.
Yes, they are friends who have been friends for a long time and have lived a life of looking after their children and working and have never really, or traveling with their husbands, and have never ever been on a holiday as a, you know, women on their own as friends. So this is their big, and there's no inside them that this is their first and last chance at having a really good time. And that's what the three of them are there for. And then they meet this girl and everything changes for them too.
Where did you start with this story? Which characters came first?
It was these three women, and it was a long short story which I sent to Christopher, my publisher, and he said either chop it in half or expand it to 5 times. So I expanded it.
So you had these three people going on a journey to a temple, and that was the story, was it?
Well, it was quite a lot happened in it, but it was basically their holiday, which was the story. But during this holiday, they had an encounter with a girl, and at that time, I didn't know who this girl was. They meet her on the beach, and they have a kind of very brief encounter, but which leaves them extremely disturbed in that story. And then I began thinking, I found myself thinking more and more about this girl and why did they feel like this about her, and then tried to follow and make, you know, see where it went.
It's quite a controversial story, isn't it? In the way that it links religion and abuse.
Yes.
That you have this line which one of the guides comes up with, which is, in ancient India, no barrier between life and love. Erotic is creation itself, so it is celebrated in our temple. Nothing wrong, please understand.
Yes.
That's really ironic in the context of the plot.
Yes, it is meant to be ironic because the temples they are looking at are 1,000 years old, at which time the erotic was really celebrated in India. There appear to have been no inhibitions. And the sculpture in the temples can be shockingly explicit to people today. And yet, at the end of that 1,000 years, you find that there are godmen using religion to abuse children or women, and that all the patriarchal, Brahminical, Hindu sort of religious infrastructure is bent on crushing both all the oppressed, which are women and Dalits and the underclass in the Indian religious. There are still temples where women are not allowed to enter.
And one of the stories is about abuse within a religious community.
Yes.
How angry are you? How much is this fueled by anger, this book?
There must be a lot. I hadn't realized, but it was a very difficult book for me to write because it was making me feel physically sick at times to sit and have to think about this and read about it and, you know. So, yes, I was, I suppose, years of any... It's not as if the women in this book are all oppressed and miserable and suffering, not at all. In fact, these three old women and this girl are all quite feisty and they hit back when they are. But you feel a lifetime of having to be that and, you know, having to cope with doing things the hard way in many ways. Not that we were suffering all the time, but so that makes you angry. I think every time you take a bus, if you think, how do I protect my back and my front and my side? Gradually, you want to kill men all over.
the structure you've chosen is quite filmic. I mean, you do use a lot of flashbacks, don't you? And it's also the way that you construct it in episodes, which sort of loop back on itself.
Yeah, I found that, I think, because it had multiple strands and narratives in different moments of time, this kind of jagged and spliced structure was what came naturally to the book. And I left it at that, yeah. And there are areas which are quite sort of dark, and you have to participate in thinking what did happen. And I have had even my mother saying, so what happened over there? And I said, I'm not going to tell you.
So bits, you mean bits in the shadows that you're not ever explicit about?
Yeah, yes, there is some of that. I have to warn you.
Yes, you don't necessarily follow everything through. What is that a decision you've made before? Or is that?
I really think, even when I read a book, that it has to have, right till the end, and even for years after, some areas of mystery and unknownness, which make you think about the book in a different way. That the book has a sort of independent life, which it will not give to the reader fully, and it will give it differently to different readers. I think that's important in a book.
We've talked a lot about the darkness of it, but it's also funny, isn't it? There's quite a lot of comedy,
yes,
particularly involving the street vendors.
Yes, that vendor is a favourite character of mine, but I think of his life as he is sort of sarcastic and nasty and violent sometimes in the way he speaks, but he's actually quite a gentle character who has obviously been displaced from somewhere, and he won't tell you where, and has made himself this little world of the tea stall on the beach, where he often cheats people by filling up their glasses with froth and not tea and so on. Yeah, it is. There are several comic strands.
And the three old ladies.
The three old ladies,
comic.
Yes. I mean, they're sure, yes, absolutely.
And they're sort of sad and comic at the same time.
And I was quite interested in seeing how, you know, because sexuality and I find that more and more in fiction that older people are seen as irrelevant. So there were readers of this book who said, why do you have these women? You know, we are interested in this girl, so give us more of the girl. And we don't know what these women are doing, they're just distracting us. But the fact that these women have, through the book, they are constantly thinking of the lives they've lived, of their relationship with their children and husbands. Even with their children, they don't always feel maternal and good about the children coming and demanding this and that from them. And the joy and freedom they feel to chuck all that and come out. And how one of them still feels tugs of flirtatiousness, although she's whatever age she is. And the others feel furious with her for being this way, wayward at her age. So I wanted all that to, you know, I wanted them to be just full-fledged human.
But there's a hint that one of them is beginning to suffer from dementia.
Yeah, she is, yes.
So there's sort of really serious stuff going on underneath the surface.
Yes, there are shadows over their lives, and you know by the end of it, you don't know what is going to happen to them, but despite that, I hope they're having a good time on the beach.
You're a journalist. You have been a journalist as well as
yes,
as well as a novelist. Yeah. How do you decide which stories to put in fiction and which stories to put in? Because there's a lot about this story, if you were to boil it down, that is very journalistic. It's mm-hmm. about child abuse mm-hmm. within a religious context. What makes this right for a novel and other stories right for news?
I don't think about writing fiction, and when I write, usually when I write pieces for a newspaper, it comes from a completely different place from this. When I write for a newspaper, it will be that I have either been commissioned and therefore I'm reacting just professionally to a topic, or something has disturbed me or interested me, and I write about that in a very direct sort of way. But this, sometimes you get a passage of words or a sense of a character or an image in your head which will not go away. And so you don't start out saying, I think child abuse is really important, so I must put it into my novel. But that's how it happened. The character came first, and when I thought about her, she turned out, I can't explain exactly, but that's how it
happened. Mm-hmm. To tell us a bit about your own life. And you're a publisher as well.
Yeah, my husband and I run a little publishing house.
How did you come to do that?
We used to work at the OUP.
Because you still do journalism
as well. I do, yes. At the journalism, yes. But not much. I do maybe one article a month or something like that.
And you were books editor of the Hindu, is that right?
That was for 2 years, yes. I was books editor of the Hindu when I had just left the OUP. I used to commission reviews and rewrite reviews and things like that. Yes, it was very enjoyable. You get to steal all the books you want.
Do you feel that your work is part of a community of writing, or what is the state of the sort of writing community in which your, or the landscape in which your novels sit?
I don't know. Do you feel it's a community need?
This is Neil Mukherjee.
Yeah.
Sorry, I probably shouldn't have outed you.
Certainly with my generation of Indian writers, you, Atish, Anjali, Rahul, yes, I do. I feel, Well, not a community, but I feel a great sense of fellow feeling, and you know,
yeah.
I would hope that we all look out for each other and support each other. Yeah. Because Indian writing in English, I've had a...
unfairness, that people who write in English automatically get lots of money or lots of readers, and they really, some of them, extraordinary writers for years, just have no access to readers because they don't get translated enough. But that's changing now, I think.
Were you ever tempted to not write in English?
My Bengali just isn't good enough. I read Bengali, but I would not be able to. I, in a natural way, I write in English. I don't write in Bengali.
Has this novel been published in India?
Yes, it's just come out.
In English?
In English, yeah.
But is it? Will it be translated?
I doubt it. My other two were not translated.
And is that usual?
No, well, if you were Harry Potter or somebody, you would be translated into Bengali. But, I mean, Amitav Ghosh is translated, so is Rushdie. So if they anticipate really big sales, then they will translate it, naturally, because they have to invest in it, in a translation. So they don't get aid for these things there. The government very rarely supports any kind of literary work by giving you grants.
And is it it's too early to say how it's gone down, how it is beginning to go down?
Nothing.
You haven't had reviews?
Yeah, no.
Because I mean, it's quite a hot potato, really, isn't it?
I'm hoping people will read it but not notice it.
That's a vain hope, I would have thought.
But the thing is that ever since Satanic Verses, I think both from the Hindu right, from fatwas, from random political parties, liberals are embattled everywhere because they do not support conservatism, and therefore there is hostility, and they will always try to silence you. And so this is not specially provocative in that sense. Or even if it had nothing, but it had that one little para which somebody picks up and loathes, then they could object to it. And the problem in India is that when people object to a book, there's no one to defend you. The state will not defend you. And if someone sues this book in any part of India and gets a stay order on it, then my publisher can't sell it anymore. And court cases in India take about 15 to 20 years to get resolved. So by which time, of course, the book is dead. Which is what would have happened with this film that they didn't allow to be shown.
The
India's Daughter film.
Oh, yeah.
So at that time, even the feminists were against the screening of the film. Their point of view was that, the film, that it was called India's Daughter was wrong because this made all India's women, you know, turn into little girls. And then they said that the case was still in court, so the convict would not get a fair trial if this was shown. But if you have a ban on showing anything when something is still in trial in India, that's effectively a lifelong ban because your book or film is dead by the time. So what we really fear as both publishers and writers is that someone somewhere will object and the book will just have to be pulped or go out of circulation. That's definitely a concern.
Have you ever had that experience as publishers?
Yes, absolutely. At the OUP there were books that... There was a book on Shivaji, the Shivaji by James Lane, and it had to be remaindered. And the mob went to the archive, which was a very, very valuable archive in Pune, which housed all the Sanskrit papers which James Lane had used to write this book, And they destroyed the archive as well. So it's completely anarchic when it comes to this kind of mob feud.
Mm-hmm. But not your own publishing house. You haven't had any.
I hope not. We are not big enough to be able to fight something like this. We just pray that nothing happens. Because you do need... which was the publishing house that agreed not to do Wendy Doniger?
Penguin.
But people were appalled that they gave in because Penguin is so rich and so big. But I know that if we had faced the same thing, we would have had to give in because we don't have the money to fight this kind of battle.
Mm. Let's just take it back into the book since we've gone off the book a bit. You begin, the chapter you read was in the first person.
Yes.
But you use first person and third person.
Yes, yeah. Right.
How did you decide to do that? And, you know, that's quite an unusual decision in a way to go between the two.
Actually, that was the case in my first book as well. I just feel quite comfortable. I feel certain parts of the book work better in first person. And I want the intimacy of the first person in those bits. But in the rest, I just want both. I want to be able to, you know, sit there and look at everything from on high and also have the first person.
And it's interesting that the first person bit is the flashback. It's not it's not, you would, one might expect that it's the present day bit that's the first person and then it flashes.
I also was interested in really writing this in two completely different styles of prose. So I worked very hard on the language this child speaks because I didn't want it to be over simple, but I didn't, it had to be sound quite different from the rest of it. So I don't know if that's worked or not.
Well, I think you have a sense of partial awareness. For example, the writing on the wall, she can't read it. She doesn't actually know what was written.
And also she often wonders if she is imagining what she thinks she remembers in throughout her memories. She's not always sure it has actually happened or that her mind has just made it up from somewhere.
In the years between that opening and coming back to the temple, she's, apart from anything else, had a pretty bad time in Europe, hasn't she?
Well, it's just been, another new thing that she's had to cope with. But she hasn't had a terribly bad time in the sense that she's learned to make herself stronger and she's turned out to be someone who can survive and cope. And actually, she's a flirty, fun, a happy person on the surface, and she manages life pretty well, and that's partly because of having been completely transplanted away from her surroundings.
Several times?
Yes, and the last time she seems to have survived better.
Okay, I think I'm going to open it out to you. Who's going to ask the first question? Have we got anyone brave enough? It's always difficult to ask the first question.
I'm just going to... You're based in India, but we're launching here, so... Are you doing a launch in India as well? Or?
Well, my Indian publisher will probably do something, but I don't yet know because publishing is not a rich industry. And so if he manages to do something, he does. But we've agreed that he'll use his publicity and marketing money to actually get the book around and visible and so on.
Is the main market the UK for this?
No, not at all. It sells all over the place in India. And you usually do as many of the festivals you can if your publisher wants you to. But the idea of these champagne launches has...
As it has here, actually.
Yeah. It happens for people who know wine merchants who will then sponsor your book launch, but otherwise it doesn't. Because book events in India are never paid. No one would pay to come and listen about a book.
But you're also going around the world, aren't you? It's not just India.
I'm going
here,
for some
here.
Festivals in Bali and Sri Lanka and so on. Those are just to see nice places, actually.
But you by invitation?
Yes, of course. But I would only go if it's a pretty place. Otherwise, to work hard in an ugly place would be...
Will this be...
That's the end of Bognor Regis.
Poor old Bognor. Will it be published in the States?
It hasn't been yet.
You don't know yet. Were your previous ones?
My previous two were published in the States, but after that...
The time you are using in your book, I haven't read the book, because, there's a chronological time. But a psychological time allows you to move freely between different time zones.
There is actually a lot of that in this, because the girl who is traveling in the present day is trying to reconstruct whether she is from this place or not, and what she remembers of it, if she does. So she's often doubtful about things, and she keeps, and sometimes she's sitting in the present, but one little incident or object will push her right back into a different place and time, and she almost loses herself at that point, and she is living in some other time frame altogether. And also there are all these flashbacks which she...
Is she meant to be schizophrenic or something? I got the impression from the way you were saying that it confuses what is happening in real life with what...
But I think we all do. I think many times it's actually... I'm not a doctor, but I know that many memories we have are... I was reading a very interesting article by, I think it was Oliver Sacks, could you... And it was all about how he thought that he had witnessed a bomb falling during a war. And then his brother told him that, no, you were not there. You were on holiday. I was there. I told you about it. But you never saw it. But he was certain he had seen it. He felt terrified by this whole episode because he felt he'd experienced it. So in that sense, all of us must have memories, especially from childhood, which are told to you, but which you feel you may have actually seen or done.
And you have it, there's a sense in it as well of when she goes back as an adult that everything's a different size.
Yes,
so the impossibility of actually mapping onto where you are now, where you were when you were a seven-year-old, and everything was so much bigger.
Yeah,
it's one of the another of those things where you get the partialness of memory very well, I think.
Yeah.
Any more? Yes.
Is there meaning of the title obvious once you've read the book?
Yes, it is.
I mean, no one will find it out then.
Well, it's really about people who have reached a point in their lives when they feel as if they need to find some different reality in order to survive. And for one of the characters, this means just going off to this different planet which has 16 moons and sleeping under those moons.
That's interesting, isn't it? It's a bit different.
Some of your subject matter is obviously very challenging or controversial for an Indian audience. We've just been talking about India's Daughter. Was there some hope in writing this novel that you could start conversations within India whereby people could start to talk about some of these things that they're not so comfortable discussing or even acknowledging taking place?
I don't think when you are writing a novel you think about these things. I mean, I don't. And when this book finished, I was really quite unsure whether I should publish it, because it was only then that I realized it might be a difficult book to publish. So now I don't know how people will talk about it or whether they will talk about it. But all I hope for my book is that people who read fiction will read it and think well of it. I don't need it to start any kind of social, you know, anything in the social world.
So what do you want people to get from it? A great tale, it's sort of suspense, nice characters?
Very often if you have a reader who, as has happened for my previous book, so people will tell you, oh, you've written about Raniket, but this is not exactly like Raniket, but you want your book to present to the reader a world which completely sucks her in, which moves her or amuses her or interests her, and you want the novel to consume the reader. And that's all you want from what you write.
So why do you think it would be difficult to publish? I mean, why are controversial topics difficult to publish overseas particularly? Since that's where you publish it.
Yeah, my publisher is in India as well as here.
Awesome.
But it's difficult only because people are shocked easily. People don't want to face all kinds of realities which exist. It's difficult particularly in India because there's such huge inequalities now that it's almost systematic to ignore the oppressed, who are the poor, the children, or animals, and cruelty to them is accepted as it's a kind of status quo. So if someone writes about it, then it happened years ago, even when Satyajit Ray made his films, that the Hindi movie world found it unpatriotic. They said he should make films about dams instead, instead of making Song of the Road, which Pothir Panchali, which showed this very poor village life. So people want you to present a happy picture, and if you don't, then they object.
Even outside India?
Outside India, I'm not that bothered, but it is within India that worries you.
Yeah.
I know you were talking about being this sort of being drawn to the world that you can write about, and I just wanted to say I've been reading The Atlas of Impossible
Okay.
and that happened for me.
Oh, thank you.
I haven't finished it.
Yeah.
Very atmospheric, very evocative.
Okay.
It's a different world. You know, so I'm looking forward to finishing it. My question is, as an Indian writer writing in English based in India, are there any joys that come from it? Because you've been talking about things that don't quite work.
Yeah.
And it's been a long time since I've left India, but I go back as a tourist to my own country, and I often see the things that you're talking about. If I go to the south, I was wondering if there are any joys in being a woman writer based out of India, writing from where you do run a kid, if you like. If there's anything to it, because one of the topics this evening was about being a woman in India, was it something of that sort? I think. A modern day woman in India today. So.
I have to say, I don't feel a woman writer. I just feel like a writer.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the little thrills and joys you get after the book is written must be the same for writers anywhere in the world, that someone reads it, someone talks to you about it, or some completely unexpected person tells you they've read something that and liked it or what.
But you've lived here as well as in India, isn't it?
I've just been a student here for 2 years, but I've never lived here as a, after that. So it was a long time ago.
So out of the three books, I've read your first two of them.
Okay.
And I think my favourite was the second one, actually, rather than something more of a folded up. Out of the three, which one's your favourite, do you think?
Oh,
that's always a difficult question to ask. It's like asking a mother whose favourite, is their favourite baby.
Yeah, I know, but there must be something,
What happens after I finish a book is that I never want to open it again. And when I do, I feel deeply embarrassed by whatever, page 20, so I go to 30 thinking that must be better, and then I find something there that I want to change. So it's not a safe proposition to read that.
If you were a man writing and the characters, the genders of your characters were reversed, people might say that it's discriminating against women. I mean, your men characters aren't very nice, most of them, are they?
Oh, no. No, I think that the temple... I'm actually very fond of the temple guide in this.
Yes.
And I thought I was entirely sympathetic to him and to this tea seller. But of course there are lots of nasty men and women.
Because there's abuse towards men as well as abuse towards women,
yeah,
towards boys. Yeah.
All the abuse in the world is in there.
But it's men who are doing the abusing, it's not women.
Well, in the ashram where she is, where she goes through the most traumatic part of her life, there are so many women there who are aiding and abetting this godman, and that is quite a normal scenario in most cases. You find that women...
So they know, they know it's going on, the women in the ashram.
Yes, they do. They are getting the girl ready when they have to, bring her to him and so on.
Because we haven't actually mentioned the ashram, because I was wondering whether that was a bit of a plot spoiler. But
that's in the...
It's part of the religious part of it.
Yeah.
Do you feel that the religion... I mean, we've talked about the controversialness of it, but the fact that you deal with religion at all might be difficult for people.
People might find it surprising, because it's not usually a topic in fiction. In Indian fiction right now, I don't know how much of it is about... It is not so much about... Religion often enters Indian fiction via mythology. So there are very intelligent reworkings of mythology and so on. But this is really about the feeling inside people of devotion, or what it does to them, of their relationship with God, if they have one, and sometimes they don't, or sometimes religion oppresses them, and sometimes it releases them and makes them feel fulfilled. So it is more about religious feeling rather than a particular religion.
And that's because you're sort of one step always slightly away from documentary reality, aren't you? Like having the fictional wall, like having a fictional resort.
Yeah. I just like making up places. I find it makes me feel interested, and I like imagining the streets and giving them names, and then I'm able to do whatever I want with the place. And I think that once when I read this Moth Smoke. It was Mohsin Hamid, and I had a Pakistani friend to whom I said I really loved the Karachi in that book. And she said, that Karachi is not the real Karachi. So I said to her that the Karachi in that book is complete Karachi for me, and that is all that matters, that the place may be invented, it may have the name of Karachi and not be Karachi at all, but it must be convincing and real to the reader. So that's what I aim for in these invented places.
You don't have any Islam in it, for example, and that's we're used to, an awful lot of novels actually now go back to that fundamental religious split, and you don't have anything about that at all.
No, this is a deeply Hindu town, and it's entirely Hindu. So, and I really would not have... That just wasn't relevant to the book in this case.
We got any more questions? One at the back,
I was just wanting to ask, because it's obviously quite a controversial subject, are you worried that the book might become sensationalised and as a result maybe overshadowed as a piece of quality fiction, or people may get it wrong, maybe focus on one thing and overlook something else?
Yes, that is a worry. So when people were asking for extract rights and so on, normally you just let them pick the passage. But this time my publishers have said that we want to okay exactly which passage you want to pick, so they don't just pull things out of context. So that's definitely a problem,
And where will what extract, where will it be extracted?
There are magazines in India now. There are lots of these internet literary magazines. It's a very good thing. It's a whole new space for literary writing. And they are always looking for content. So those people ask you for short extracts.
Is it predominantly anti-Hinduism and negative about the religion? Or do you share the positives as well?
No. In fact, it has characters who are deeply involved in Hinduism and religion, who are believers, and it looks at the problems of belief, which may be of different kinds, but it does not at all run down the religion. In fact, it sees this religious feeling as a very real and something that gives their life meaning in the cases of these other characters. And for some, it has been oppression and unhappiness.
It reminds me slightly of that Amir Khan film. The Amir Khan film?
Oh,
I think Big Blood.
Which one?
I watched half of it. Yeah.
Which one did you say?
I
haven't seen
it. I watched a bit of it, but it sounds similar to that. Yeah. The other question I had was about Indian women. Do you think that they're misrepresented or that there's stereotyping of them outside India? Like, cause you're talking about portraying them as spunky and all this sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But if you speak to people who don't know that much about India, they often just talk about rape. It's this country that you go to and you believe that you get raped.
Yeah.
Are you trying to address that kind of negative?
Yeah, I think there's just lack of knowledge, I suppose, that there's a generalization and stereotyping, and all Indian women are seen as the plight of women and oppression and so on. Whereas it's quite different in different parts of the country. Where I live in the hills, even the very poor village women have much more, they are the extroverts who are doing all the work, they're outside the houses, they talk as much as the men, probably more. So there's nothing cowed down about women in the hills. And in daily life, you see these droves when you're taking the metro and so on of young people from the hinterland now in the workplace. And all of them are making their way across the city and surviving. So there are many kinds of reality. They're not just one.
And in a way, your question is answered by the characterization of the three older women. They're both, it's completely... You know, they're not usual centres of fiction, and they are religious. That's why they're there. That is what gives
them
meaning.
Except one of them, who just wants to sit by the sea.
And also they are strong women.
Yes,
who carry their lives with them.
They've lived their lives for other people till this point, when suddenly this rebelliousness has come into them, that we are going to do this and we are going to enjoy ourselves.
Somebody's got to make a film of this book. So see it. Have we got any more?
It sounds like that Best Exotic Marriage.
Yeah, I was going to say it is. Yeah, a little bit. Got any more?
I've been having a lot of discussions with friends with all the sort of freedom and a writer's freedom and the responsibility which comes with it. So do you think, in light of the whole the whole kind of showing India in a negative light to the West and things like that, do you feel that this might put India in a sort of viewed in a kind of, again, one of these unsafe countries with all the sort of child abuse and all that? Do you think it's going to sort of do that, or do you think there's redeeming parts of the book which will...
I hope so. I don't think it shows up the whole... I don't think it's like a case study for the country or, you know, anything like that in the book. You can see that this girl's had a very unusual life. I don't think the book implies that life for all little girls in India is like this. But that it happens. And I think it's important, if you're a writer, to remember that there are many different kinds of reality that, and if you're not ever going to talk about the unpleasant stuff, then what's the point of anything? So it's okay.
But the other point about her is that she's an orphan. You know, she's an orphan. Okay. She's very vulnerable. She is a girl as well, but you know, she's one of the displaced. So there's that whole context, and she's displaced from another country.
Yes, she is, and she absolutely has nobody here. So, and she doesn't even know. Because she's so little when she comes, she has no idea what she can do or can't do to change her situation. She's little, so... Yeah. My mother is very disturbed by many of the characters being orphans.
I was going to ask how your mother... How do you... Does your mother take
it? Why is there an orphan in each of your books?
You always have orphans, do you?
As it happens, in the first book there was an orphan. In the second book, the woman had both parents either dead or dying. Yeah.
Has your mother been allowed to read this book, finally?
Well, at first she was told not to. She asked my husband very anxiously, because she often read my drafts, and this time she said, why is she not showing me the draft? Mm-hmm. So I had told her, no, you shouldn't read this book. Because she is actually quite religious, and she goes on pilgrimages and stuff, and I didn't want her, you know, hating every page. And so she asked Rukun, do you think I should read it? And he thought a bit and said, no, you shouldn't.
But she did.
Well, when I sent her the actual copy, she read about 20 pages and rang me up sounding actually tearful and saying, I can't read it. I'm very sorry, but this is the first of your books that I will not read. So I said, don't worry about it. And then I said, just read about the old women and you'll be fine. But then she read it full of.
And when she'd read it, she was...
She said she just skipped certain parts which she found hard to digest. But she read it.
Well, there you go. There's your compliment from your mother. And I think that's probably about it, unless anybody's got one last question they want to get in. You'll be signing books now. Yes, signing books.
Books will be on sale outside.